and welcome into the Who's On podcast, part of the Sabre Podcast Network. For the first time since 2019, Virginia taking home the Commonwealth Cup, beating Virginia Tech 27-7, and most importantly, clinching a spot in the ACC Championship game where they will play Duke on Saturday at 8 o'clock at Bank of America Stadium down in Charlotte. And here to talk about all of it, I got David Teal, the Hall of Famer from the Virginian Pilot, to break down a big week for Virginia in this program.
Oh, my gosh, yes, Preston. And, you know, if you're going to beat your rival, might as well do it to qualify for the ACC championship game yet again, just like 2019 with Bryce Perkins. But unlike 2019, Virginia was facing a very poor Virginia Tech team. That contest 6 years ago, the winner was going to the ACC championship game. It was two quality clubs on the field that night, and Bryce Perkins had to be at his exceptional best to win that game.
Yeah.
Chandler Morris just needed to be efficient and okay on Saturday night, because the Hokies offense especially, without their leading rusher, Marcellus Hawkins, without their best receiver, Aiden Green, they had no chance against that Virginia defense. And if not for that late, 57-yard touchdown pass, yeah, we'd have been looking at historic lows in total offense, and we were already looking at historic lows in pass completions and first downs. They completed four passes and got five first downs. I mean, come on.
I think you said earlier the last time they had been, Virginia Tech had been shut out was 1995, and against UVA it was 1991. It did turn out to be the largest win for Virginia over Virginia Tech since that 1991 game where they won 38-0, winning this one by 20 points. But it played out as it should have, like that Virginia was a far better team than Virginia Tech. And I think all week people understood that. It was just, was there any kind of voodoo magic that was going to go on with this Commonwealth Clash game that has kind of befallen Virginia over the last 20 years?
Well, that's one of the beauties, Preston, of overhauled rosters in the portal era. Really, I mean, most of the players on the Virginia team, they don't have that baggage. Now, a good number of them do, but Chandler Morris, no. Jamari Taylor, no. Mitchell Melton, no. Devin Neal, no. Yeah, that's kind of unknown history to them. Now, when they walk in the building, do they hear about it? Yeah, but they didn't have anything to do with it. So in that regard, I think the Cavaliers were able to play free and confidently, and it showed.
I would say if anyone understood, though, it was Mitchell Melton, who had lost four times to rival Michigan.
Yes.
At Ohio State. So he actually got two wins on the day because Ohio State finally ended that streak for him. But he probably understood a little bit what that felt like. But let's just go start from the beginning here. You know, obviously clinching a spot in the ACC championship game. It's the second 10-win season in program history. It's the first time that they finished in sole possession of first place in the ACC after the regular season. And it was Tony Elliott's first win against Virginia Tech. I'll leave it there. What is your one big take from this game about UVA?
Took care of business. Very, very, you know, we used the word earlier, efficiently, kind of methodically, and you know, showed no real mercy. And that's what you expect. And Tony Elliott has used the word throughout the season, belief. And he has instilled it in this team. And it has carried over through just two setbacks, both close games, and through some, you know, harrowing overtime games. And more recently, some pretty emphatic beatdowns of both Duke and Virginia Tech. I think it's pretty clear that the Cavaliers are playing their best football at the best time, and that's November and December.
Making it a November to remember, as some people say. Yeah, you look at it's kind of belief delivered, because this team has been talking about getting to this point in Charlotte since back in January. Of course, when Chandler Morris said the, now famous line, I didn't come from Texas to win five or six games. And they got there. I think that's, they kind of talked about it all year, and people, laughed at times. They were picked 14th in the ACC preseason media poll, and there they are at the top of the standings at the end of the year. They kind of delivered on what they talked all year about.
They did. And, Morris has a swagger about him. And I think it's contagious. And let's be honest, schedule didn't hurt either.
Great schedule.
a very manageable path. And they took advantage of it. A lot of teams don't. Virginia's had manageable schedules previously and never remotely approached this level of success. And now they have, and good on them.
It's one thing to say it's an easy schedule, because I think that never changed. Like, before the season, we looked at this and thought it would be an easy schedule. Now, Florida State kind of rose at the beginning of the season, and they quickly plummeted after that loss to Virginia. And then
Virginia broke Florida State.
I've been saying that all year. Like, and it was kind of interesting, because last year, Boston College was looking really good when they came into Charlottesville, and it seemed like Virginia broke that Tommy Castellanos team. And then they did it again against Florida State.
Yeah, I mean, if Deuce Robinson doesn't bobble that ball running through the end zone, and Florida State somehow wins that game, how might the two seasons have gone? Well, obviously we'll never know, but it's a fascinating question to consider.
It's still incredible that we get to the end of the season and they never won a road game. Florida State, and they a road game in the ACC, right? And they also finished without bowl eligibility for the second straight year. It's incredible just kind of how far they fell off. Louisville also, dealt with some injury issues in the second half, but we always knew this was going to be an easier schedule for Virginia. But again, at the end of the day, like you said, you got to go out there and manage that and win the games.
They did. And you play the games as they arise and take care of business. And that's precisely what they have done.
Let's get into our who's on player of the game real quick. Maddox Marcellus, the linebacker, wins the poll. Great game from him, filling in for the injured Cam Robinson, who obviously is out for the rest of the season with an ACL injury now. And that was a big question. How were they going to kind of respond? They did well against Duke in the moment. But with Marcellus now, 9 tackles, had a sack, and the interception that I kind of felt like that kind of just set the tone for the game. And it just Tech never could have recovered from there.
Well, put him in business right away at the 46-yard line. Off a deflection, and I don't know how many plays it took Chandler Morris to then get him in the end zone. He threw that 26-yard dart to, I think it was Harris, right?
Harris.
And on a 3rd and 6, and right then and there, I thought, okay, it's going to be a pretty emphatic Virginia performance, taking advantage of that, pouncing immediately. And Virginia Tech is just not equipped to come from behind, even from some. Once it got to 14, I thought, okay, this is insurmountable, given the Hokies' offense. But I thought it was interesting post game that Tony Elliott spoke about how, Maddox Marcellus was a starter at Eastern Kentucky, and came to Virginia and has not been a starter, but didn't let that bother him, or at least not on the field. And he's long and rangy, and you see him out there and you think, there's potential there, but he's not Cam Robinson. And Cam Robinson literally won football games for Virginia. And how many linebackers can say that. You know, Cal, Louisville, Washington State, without those three plays, what happens in those contests? But since Robinson went down, and you know, and when he was out earlier with the collarbone,
yep.
both Marcellus and Landon Dantley were good coming off the bench.
Yeah, Marcellus has played in a lot of third down packages this year because they want to get his athleticism out there on the field. And it was great when he was pairing with Cam Robinson. Now he's got to do a little bit more of the heavy lifting on those third downs. And he was spying Kyren Drones throughout the night. And Drones got loose for maybe a run or two. But like I thought it was a really good game and kind of a sign that, okay, maybe they could hold the fort down. Because I was thinking after the Robinson injury, I think defensive line has really kind of started to live up to what people thought it could be. And I think the secondary has improved greatly. So maybe, you know, the tides rising up will lift up the linebackers even without Cam Robinson.
Agreed. And it early this season, I think we were all a little skeptical of Virginia's defense, and there were some busts that allowed some long plays. You know, what have they got here? Same old Virginia. And man, Rudzinski and his staff and these players have really turned it around to where they are right now. They are an elite defense right now.
Yeah, looking at the stats this year, second in points allowed in the ACC, third in total yards. They held Virginia Tech to the fewest amount of yards and points all season that Tech had. Second fewest passing yards, third fewest in rushing yards. It was a pretty dominant performance. Like you said, it just didn't seem like Virginia Tech could ever kind of get out of first gear against this Virginia defense.
Yeah, I misspoke earlier. I think it was six first downs pressing. That's the Hokies' fewest since 1998. Fewest pass completions, I think, since the 80s. Just total dominance. And you look at Duke's numbers this season. What Virginia did to Duke 2 weeks ago, same thing. Season lows and points and yards per play. You know, Darian Mensah went into that game as the leading passer in the Power Four in terms of yards per game. And Virginia made him look pedestrian. And that's because, as Manny Diaz said on a call with us yesterday, we couldn't block them.
Yeah.
If you can't block them, good luck.
Yeah, I think Virginia had four sacks in that game against Duke. Fisher Kamak and Mitchell Melton getting back there a couple times. Flipping to the other side, offense. Jamari Taylor finishes this game 80 yards, a rushing touchdown, and a passing touchdown off the direct snap. That was a twist. I know they've been dying to get in there. First ACC running back with a passing and rushing touchdown in the same game since Clemson's Will Shipley in 2021, whose offense coordinator, of course, was Tony Elliott. But the numbers for Taylor this season, we can kind of look at it as season total now. He's the first UVA running back to lead the ACC in rushing since Antoine Womack in 2000, so 25 years. And he had 14 rushing touchdowns this year. UVA as a team last year had 14 rushing touchdowns total. He's kind of been a culture changer on that offense.
He has. Now, just a little warning, he hasn't led the ACC in rushing yet because postseason stats count and it's based on yards per game. So whether he ends up in that position, we don't know. He will be almost certainly the first Cavalier running back to be first team all conference since Alvin Pierman in 2004. So again, more than two decades since a Virginia running back has had that honor. And yeah, he's been terrific. And, you know, X Brown goes down and you thought, oh, you know, are they going to have to lean too much on Taylor? But no, he's been up to that task. And he really disguised that little pass well. You know, he staggered toward the line of scrimmage and then stopped and paused and, you know, and threw it to Ennis in the back of the end zone.
Yeah, I've, I've said all year that the direct snap has just worked to perfection all season, and so I've been confused at times when they don't like to use it.
Yeah.
And I'm just
Like
like,
down on the goal line against NC State, maybe?
exactly. Like it's one of those plays, just like the Eagles tush push in the NFL. It's like, just keep running it until it doesn't work. Like, I don't see the thought behind that, but obviously they've been setting this part of it up, and now, like, if you're considering that too, that's one more thing for the defense to think of down near the goal line on the 1 yard line, and it's a pretty hard play to stop.
Well, what's the phrase Tony Elliott used Saturday night postgame? Trying to keep defenses honest. And that's going to make it more difficult when they know Virginia has that in its hip pocket.
Chandler Morris, we mentioned earlier, kind of just did enough and was efficient and had his first rushing touchdown since the Florida State game. A lot of talk about, was he going to be able to run the ball effectively with the shoulder injury that he's been nursing all season long? And there's the play right before that direct snap, actually, where he ran to the goal line, almost got in, but he lowered his left shoulder, which is the shoulder that's been bothering him, and took a huge hit. And it's just another example of just kind of what he has meant to this UVA offense this year.
And turnover free. And that's if you get that from your quarterback, and he wasn't turnover free in Durham,
No.
had that late pick six, that annoyed both him and Tony Elliott, because they're ahead of that game 31-3, and then you look, or 34-3, and you look at that final score, but clearly Virginia was the superior team that day. But no, Morris on Saturday night was just he what I think the phrase Elliott used was he was like a point guard
Yeah.
distributing the ball to his different playmakers, and he did so very effectively.
And the part that I've always kind of appreciated about his game is his pocket presence and awareness. It just seems like anytime guys get into the backfield, he's able to kind of sidestep, get out of the pocket, and make some of those plays. I know people this year have made the reference to Baker Mayfield and Brett Favre as kind of just. I think he had one pass to, he was trying to fit into the seam to Sage Ennis, where it was like, that kind of seemed like a risky Brett Favre type throw that you just kind of take, and maybe don't do that one again. But he's going to take those risks, and sometimes they pay off like that. Looking at a couple key injuries coming out of this, obviously the big one is Mikhail Boley. Tony Elliott said it was an ankle injury. Boley was on crutches at the end of the game. Ben York filled in for him, did a fine job. But that's going to be a big one for a guy that I'm sure is going to get some all ACC considerations this week.
He should get all ACC considered. You look at Pro Football Focus and their grades. Boley was on my ballot. He was not first team, but he was certainly on my ballot. And yeah, and Ben York, who had spent most of his playing time this season on the right side, shifted over to the left side. And according to Tony Elliott, he too had been nursing an ankle somewhat. And Elliott said they didn't have to change much with him in there. But Duke has some effective edge rushers.
They do.
So if Boley is a no-go Saturday, York's going to get tested, and you can bet that Manny Diaz and his staff will find new ways to test him.
Yeah, that's going to be the real question, because that Duke defensive line has some good players. They were able to kind of keep them at bay last game. But obviously, coaches, when they see an injury kind of replacement like this, they smell blood in the water and they're going to go after him for sure on Saturday. Just early thoughts on this ACC championship game matchup. I know it's not the one most would have predicted or even wanted a couple weeks ago.
No, it's incredibly problematic for the ACC, optically, and perhaps when it comes to the college football playoff, to have a 7-5 team in the championship game. Now, it's happened before. Pittsburgh was 7-5 in 2018 and made the title game. And I'm old enough to remember 2012 when Georgia Tech was 6-6
Yeah.
in the ACC championship game, but won a coastal division tiebreaker with actually two teams that were ineligible in Miami and North Carolina, But Georgia Tech had beaten them during the regular season, so the Jackets would have gone despite the sanctions, even if they hadn't been there for the Canes and the Heels. But this time, when you have the risk of the league missing the college football playoff completely, it is not a good situation. And they do need to do something with the tiebreaker that can have some kind of common sense, because in no way, shape, or form is Duke more deserving, Manny Diaz's protest notwithstanding last night, than 10-2 Miami. I mean, you look at the five teams that tied for second place for Virginia, each of the other four has a win over someone in the group except Duke. Duke didn't beat anybody in the group. In fact, Duke only played George Tech among the group and lost to the Yellow Jackets in Durham. So it is really, really going to be an issue. And I have to believe that Jim Phillips and the athletic directors will take a look at this tiebreaker, which, by the way, Preston, is the same tiebreaker that the SEC and the Big 12 and the Big 10 have. The issue is, when those conferences had ties, especially the SEC with Georgia, Ole Miss, A&M, and Bama, those teams were all 7-1 and had lost one or two games the entire year. Duke flopped in the non-conference and went 1-3, losing to Tulane and UConn and Illinois. And on the flip side, Miami in the non-conference beat Notre Dame, Florida, South Florida. So come on, you tell me which is the better and more deserving team.
Yeah, it is interesting because Manny brought it up that, you know, if this is going to be the case, then they're just not going to schedule, you know, those types of teams out of conference play. You know, they played Tulane and Illinois and a UConn team that went ahead of 9-3 season. So I thought that was interesting because that's been a thing that Steve Sarkisian down at Texas has talked about in regards to the Ohio State game. And obviously Kirk Cignetti before the season with the game that they canceled against Virginia, got some headlines about, you know, wanting to schedule lighter in the non-conference.
It's an interesting point, but I think it misses the fact that Miami scheduled ambitiously and won those games.
Yeah.
So, and that's the reason that Miami, you know, now Miami may not make it as an at-large, but they're on the cusp, and it's because of their non-conference schedule and the success they had against that schedule. So if Manny Diaz wants to schedule four cupcakes in the non-conference, fine, have at it. But he's going to risk never being in the at-large conversation.
Yeah.
That's a you choice.
Yeah. You could argue, though, Miami has not been rewarded as much. They're on the cusp of it. But again, we keep going back to this head-to-head with Notre Dame that just doesn't seem to come up in the conversation in the committee room at this point. You know, there was a couple weeks ago where I can't remember who it was at the time because they've swapped chairman at this point. But, you know, they're saying that they weren't even in the same pool. I think they're in the same pool now that they're talking about, but it's just wild, just the kind of conversations that are going on behind the closed doors right now.
It is. And that's why there needs to be more transparency. You know, once February hits in basketball, we're all looking at the net rankings because the NCAA updates them every day with every result. And meanwhile, the college football playoff sits down there in Grapevine and guards their metrics like some kind of state secret. Yeah. That's BS, man. Put them on your website. Let us all look at them.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is the thing I learned after 10 years in TV news is that something only happens after something bad happens. So if the ACC changes the tiebreakers, it's because something bad happened this year.
No doubt. Because there is a very strong probability, and again, Manny Diaz can lobby all he wants that an 8-5 Duke would belong in the CFP. Not going to happen. Yeah. If the Blue Devils beat Virginia, they will not be in the college football playoff, unless JMU were to lose to Troy. then maybe. But if JMU, even without Bob Chesney, or with Bob Chesney already being
Little
Eastern,
distracted.
like, yes, at 12-1, James Madison would go before an 8-5 Duke team. I'm almost 100% certain of that.
What do you think of this matchup, though, as we kind of look at the stuff on the field? These two teams obviously played just less than 3 weeks ago down in Durham. It was probably Virginia's most complete performance of the season, minus a little, spurt there in the fourth quarter. It's, they always say it's tough, and I think this is these matchups when you face the same team again are always really interesting with the coaching in it. How does the team that won react versus the team that lost?
Agreed. And it's more like the NFL, where you play your division rivals twice every year, and who knows, you might see them in the playoffs for a third time. And this, I forget how many championship games Tony Elliott was in as a Clemson assistant. Twice during that time, they had rematches. They had a rematch against Virginia Tech in 2011 and a rematch against Notre Dame in 2020, and in each case, the Tigers won the rematch. Now, they had beaten Virginia Tech during the regular season in 11 and had lost to the Irish during the regular season in 20. But that first game with between Notre Dame and Clemson was an epic.
Yeah, it was a
What
great game.
transpired in Durham 2 weeks ago was anything but an epic. That was domination. And it's hard, I think, at least for me, having been in the press box that day and watched those two teams compete. Man, I find it a little difficult to envision that Duke is just going to flip that on its head and stroll into Bank of America Stadium Saturday night and beat UVA.
Yeah, it there's a lot of adjustments that Manny Diaz and his team will have to make. And mind you, like they're playing without Cam Robinson now. They played the majority of that game without Cam Robinson, save
Yes.
for maybe two, three plays. So the defense will be pretty much the same unit that faced them the last time. And it'd be interesting to see what we get down there Saturday night at 8 o'clock. Before we move away from the Commonwealth clash, I do want to look a little bit ahead to the future of the rivalry, because I thought some of Tony Elliott's points. Obviously, he said, it was good for 365 days. We'll do it again next year. But I thought the part that him talking about UVA being a worthy rival to Virginia Tech was really interesting and telling. And just your thoughts on the future of this rivalry game as now James Franklin comes onto the scene in Blacksburg.
It could be fun. I mean, maybe we're entering an era of George Welch versus Frank Beamer, where literally it was like a tennis match, volleying back and forth for superiority in the state. And heck, in 1995, Preston, the Virginia Tech game matched two conference champions. You had Virginia champions of the ACC and Virginia Tech champions of the Big East. That's how good those two programs were under George and Frank. And it was such a privilege to cover those games and to have absolutely no idea what might happen each time they met. So I thought Tony Elliott's choice of words Saturday night was really good. And he lived that Clemson South Carolina rivalry when Dabo first started, man. South Carolina was kicking his backside, and there was a lot of pressure on him to break that streak, and he eventually did. And now the Tigers kind of own the Gamecocks. The tide has turned. But rivalries are better when they're competitive. And as Elliot said, we're not going to win it every year. But man, let's make this thing really, really interesting. And I think we certainly could have that. James Franklin already making recruiting splashes out there, and I think he'll make more tomorrow and on Wednesday for National Signing Day.
Yeah, that'll be an interesting part of this week. I still can't believe we have a National Signing Day in the middle of Conference Championship week. I always didn't like it, but now I really don't like it as we're trying to focus on covering a football game on Saturday. But yeah, really interested to see kind of what this rivalry game turns into, and hopefully we just don't get another 19 of the last 20 games going to one side of the rivalry. Either way, honestly, like you want to see both sides kind of, like you said, like it was back with George Welch and Frank Beamer, and just both sides kind of competing each year. We did have some, I guess, not really breaking news, but official news this morning. UVA will play NC State in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, at Nilton Santos Stadium. It's going to be week zero, August 29th. It's the first ever college football game in South America. It will be an ACC game for any that had any questions. Just your impressions of this game. It has a lot of pros and cons when you look at some of the message boards.
Random. We're accustomed to college football games in Europe, and it's specifically Ireland. And North Carolina's playing TCU in Ireland on the same day.
No.
I wonder where Jim Phillips will go. Will he go back to his homeland in Ireland, or is he going to go to Brazil? I'm guessing he'll be in Brazil with the Cavaliers since he's got two teams in that game. But first ever college football game in South America. I'll be interested, Preston, in the financials.
Yes.
What is the lure here? And I've filed my FOIA request, and we'll
As
see
many
what,
have, yeah.
we'll see what it unearths. And Virginia will still have six home games, four ACC plus Norfolk State and Delaware, I believe, in the non-conference. So we'll see how the rest of the schedule plays. I would imagine after playing week zero overseas, the Cavaliers will likely have an open date week one.
Which is interesting because I looked at the teams that played in Ireland this year. They did not have open dates coming back. I think that was Kansas State and was Iowa State.
Iowa State.
Yeah, they did not have open dates the following week. So interested to see what the ACC does there, because the other game, the non-conference games, are scheduled. So it would only be an ACC game that could go that week.
And then later they've got the neutral in Charlotte against WVU. How the schedule is spread out will be interesting to watch.
You did have the great stat that this is the longest game Virginia will have to play by 3 miles.
Credit to the interwebs travelmath.com, and the distance between Charlottesville and Rio is 3 miles longer than it is from Charlottesville to Honolulu, which is where Virginia played Georgia in the 2000 Oahu Classic in George Welch's final game as the head coach of the Cavaliers.
Why I thought it was safe to say that it was the longest game, but barely, evidently.
3 miles according to travel math, and who are we to dispute travel math?
No, you can't. And real quick, because I know a lot of people ask about this, and you mentioned the financials. That is the biggest driving force behind playing
Sure.
a game like this, especially in the age of the transfer portal and NIL revenue sharing and all of that stuff. Like, that is the driving force behind a game like this, and why you give up, a home game at Scott Stadium to play this in Rio.
100%. And might there be some kind of financial carrot for the players as well? We have the new MTE out in Las
Yeah.
Vegas offering bonuses for teams for winning and such. So I'm really interested to see the particulars here. And again, as we've talked about before, the ACC has a new revenue distribution model based on television ratings. This will likely be a standalone game. It won't be going head to head on an ESPN network with Carolina and TCU because of the time differences between Rio and Dublin. So a chance for the Cavaliers and the Wolf Pack to cash in on a large television audience that perhaps they otherwise would not draw during a regular, say, week three game at Scott Stadium.
Yeah, anytime you get on one of those main ESPN networks, you have a good chance to get a big draw, and now that matters in the television revenue distribution, like you said. And I think Rio only an hour difference.
Yes.
Yeah, so it'll probably be a, if we're considering that the Ireland game is usually a little earlier in the day.
It's usually noon
Yeah.
our time, and
yeah.
I'm imagining that UVA and State are going to be prime time.
Yeah, so a good chance to get a lot of viewers in that first game, but just a interesting note to start the day here as we get ready for a really busy conference championship week between Virginia and Duke down in Charlotte. David Teal has plenty coming up this week, I'm sure, as we get prepped for Saturday down in Charlotte.
No doubt. And as we mentioned, signing day as well. And we got JMU in the Sun Belt Championship game Friday night. We got Virginia and Dayton hoops on a noon tip in Charlotte. Going to be quite a day for Cavaliers fans in the Queen City.
Are you doing all three? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Wow. I thought Saturday was busy for us covering basketball and football after that, but adding the JMU game on top of that, good for you, sir.
Yeah, not going to be a lot of sleep involved, Preston. You
yeah.
may have to nudge me a little bit on press row or up in the press box. Say, wake up, Teal.
Hey, that's what this time of year is all about. It's a busy week here. Obviously, we got this podcast today coming out, recapping Virginia Tech, looking ahead a little bit. Later in the week, I also have ESPN's Andrea Adelson joining me to break down the matchup between Virginia and Duke and preview this game, and also talk a little bit about her article she just did on the Virginia Cavaliers. And then we also have our signing day special, where we will have break down what's happening on signing day, and also have a couple of the guys that signed with UVA coming on the podcast. So busy as always. David Teal, thank you, sir. I will see you later in the week. But for now, hit the bell icon, subscribe on YouTube to the Who's On podcast, follow, subscribe, leave 5-star reviews on Apple, Spotify, and we will see you later in the week.